Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Many in Ames have this week off for spring vacation. If you're enjoying a wintry staycation here in Ames, thanks for tuning in. If not, I'm pulling for you. We're all in this together. There's snow on the ground this morning, and it's not going to melt right away with some frigid temps tomorrow, Tuesday. But here at KHOI, we haven't forgotten that spring begins next week. So we've got a story about birds landing on paintings in the second half of the show. Also, a fresh young performer, Evan Campbell, will be in. Evan is playing on Thursday at the Pantorium Sessions. But first, let's start the show with a phenology from our wildlife correspondent, Pat Schlarbaum.
Phenology is the chronicling of nature's happenings on the date they occur. The first woodland wildflower of spring or the last osprey of autumn are recorded in a journal for future reference. Today's focus on phenology is about squirrel nests. And possibly you have wondered, how do squirrels put their leaf nests together so that they don't fall apart? And I hope all the listeners have seen these big mass of leaves that the squirrels use. Once the leaves have fallen, squirrel nests, and they're called a dray, D-R-E-Y, are easy to see, often in an oak providing acorns or near a grapevine offering support. Location is important, and a leafy nest can be built near a tree trunk, between limbs, in the crotch of a tree, or on the strong limb at least 20 feet above ground. Built in summer or early fall, the dray, or the nest, begins as a collection of small, chewed-off branches bearing green leaves that are woven together. Even though they have browned by winter, the leaves continue to cling tightly to their branches because they were harvested before the tree began dropping its leaves. The branches are loosely woven into a hollow sphere, the inner surface of which is lined with a variety of materials, including grass, leaves, moss, pine needles, and shredded bark. The outer layer of leaves sheds rain and provides protection from wind while the lining insulates against cold. The entrance hole faces the tree trunk. Flat or incomplete drays are either the remains of summer sleeping platforms or the efforts of young squirrels. Squirrels usually build a couple of drays, allowing an option should one nest be disturbed by a predator or infested with pesky lice or fleas. Hollow trees are the preferred nest sites for nurseries in raising their young. And that's the phenology for today about squirrel nests or drays that are beginning to be constructed in the woods. This is Pat Schlarbaum, and you're listening to Community Radio 89.1 KHOI, the heart of Iowa.
And we are so grateful to Pat for giving us those insights into the world around us. I'm afraid not a few squirrels lost their nest last week. Let's see how the squirrels will fare this week with a weather report from Elwin Taylor.
Well, of course, we're waking up to some snow from last night here this Monday morning, and we're talking about that right now with ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Elwin Taylor. I guess it's proof positive, Elwin, that just because we set our clocks ahead an hour doesn't necessarily bring in the return of springtime.
Oh, it almost was a threat, and the weather had measured up to that. The snow was heaviest in northeast Iowa, but there was still some, and there's some intermittent problems on roads all the way from Denison to Ames. Then when you get east of Ames, it got heavier until as you got over toward Clinton Way, you go to a place, just south of Waterloo area with 8 inches. There were some 9-inch amounts reported overnight as far as the snow goes. We do anticipate that the storm, which hurt by 6 a.m. this morning, was moving south toward the southern border of the state, most of it south of Des Moines, and was getting lighter. We'll still have some intermittent things as we go along. Nevertheless, the cold winds that have been coming in from Canada way will give way to warmer conditions as we get a little bit deeper in the week. In fact, we do anticipate that we may not even have freezing temperatures on Thursday night, And on Friday, a high near 50. 6 to 10 day outlook, warmer than usual, all the way from near to the Canadian border down to Phoenix, and that does include Iowa.
Doesn't sound too bad once we get through today and the next few days. A little bit of a warm-up. ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Ellen Taylor joining us. I'm Vaughn Kittleson.
And KHOI has also been limping along after our most recent severe weather event. Last week's stormy Monday knocked our station off the air with lightning strikes up at our tower site near Story City. Our volunteer chief engineers have been putting in a lot of time trying to patch together a studio-to-tower signal through our phone line, and our station engineer has been putting in a lot of extra hours as well to help with the troubleshooting. You may have heard our PSA. We've hired our tower climber to climb the tower today. Weather may be an obstacle for that, but we should know more very shortly about what is wrong with our system and why we're going off the air occasionally. And hopefully, more important, we'll be able to do those repairs needed to give our listeners a more consistent signal. Thank you for your patience. Well, as it so happens, we have in the studio an expert in severe weather. Sitting right beside me, Keith Morgan, coordinator of Story County Emergency Management Agency.
Good morning.
Welcome, Keith. And you're here to talk about severe weather.
Yes, Severe Weather Awareness Week is scheduled for the end of March. It's scheduled at that time, even though we may have snow outside right now. We want people to start thinking about severe weather so that they can be prepared when it hits.
Now, snow is never severe?
Some of our statistics show that we have lost people during snowstorms. So all the different kinds of weather can be hazardous and even fatal if not properly planned for.
But when you speak of severe weather, you're typically thinking of things like tornadoes or lightning storms, or what is the sort of mind image that you pull up when you say severe weather?
For severe weather, especially when we come into the summertime, we're looking at the more rapidly occurring types of weather, which do lead to high winds, tornadoes, flooding, all of those events which seem to take people a little bit more by surprise, and they're more hazardous because of that. We've known this snowstorm was going to be coming for quite a while, and even though we may know that severe weather, that there's a chance for storms, exactly where they're going to hit is a lot less predictable in the summertime, spring, and on in through the fall.
Okay. And so you're here to help us be prepared for those eventualities.
Yes, I am. What I'd like to talk about first off is that, so far we've already experienced two rounds of severe weather. Some of it was down south the first time, and then it came through here just a week ago. A week ago, Monday night, I was out looking at 8 power poles that were knocked down just west of Gilbert out there. So it can happen. Unfortunately, some of the statistics we have from 2013 through 2015 from the National Weather Service shows that 12 people have been killed here in Iowa due to severe weather. And the variety of ways that people have been injured and killed is significant. First off, 3 people were killed due to winds. 3 people were killed due to tornadoes. 2 people were killed due to flooding. 2 people were killed due to lightning, which is the one area that a lot of people don't take into account when they're doing their severe weather planning. And we had 2 people that were killed due to snowstorms. So you can see that it's all the different mechanisms that are out there are affecting people right here in Iowa, and we want people to start thinking about it now.
Wow. Well, without getting too deeply into the gory details, can you say a bit more about how one dies due to wind or how one dies due to lightning?
Wind and lightning, and those are 2 very good ones to talk about. Winds, people may be out camping and haven't thought about what are they going to do if they're out camping and winds occur. Or do they have their camper underneath a tree that has a lot of dead branches on it? When I was backpacking, we'd call those widowmakers because people don't look above where they're pitching their tent. Severe weather comes up during the night, and they're killed by that. Lightning is the one that a lot of people underestimate how far out lightning can go. They say that if you can hear it, you ought to be clearing where you're at and trying to get under shelter, because lightning can hit 5 miles or so away from a thunderstorm. So, again, it's one of those areas that people don't consider. A lot of sports activities going on during the summertime, a lot of outdoor activity, people out on the water. When you start seeing those storms coming, if you can hear thunder, it's time to start seeking shelter.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing worse than being at the swimming pool on one of those days where the storm is just sort of teasing around the edges and you can barely see the lightning, but you got to get out of the water.
You need to get out of the water because you'll typically underestimate the how far out lightning can reach.
Now, with wind, I imagine, you know, just surveying my backyard after last Monday's event, that loose objects or, you know, large unbolted objects can be a big part of the hazard with wind.
One of the biggest problems that we see in a lot of the urban areas are all of these trampolines that are out there. They're just huge frisbees. And they really, if you're going to have one of those, you need to make sure that they're staked down very, very solidly, because once one of those gets lifted up and starts flying. Another thing is, if you have an outdoor activity, we've heard of it where you may have one of those large tents. And those can get pulled up and can be hazardous. But anything that's outside can be a hazard. The other thing, just as you've mentioned, walk outside, look at your trees. When was the last time that you checked to see if there were any branches that are overhanging your house? And make sure that those are trimmed back to make sure that they don't fall on your house.
Yeah, those squirrels are in kind of a quandary because they're looking for those empty trunks, you know, which are associated with dead or dying trees, but, you know, if they build their nest in a limb of a dying tree, you know, they might lose their home, too.
They might lose their home, or if you want to leave it there, you might lose your home. So, yes, if there's get your trees checked out, especially a lot of times there's a lot of rot on the inside of the trees that you can't see. Get a specialist out there to look at it.
Okay. Other issues, you always talk about the notification system, so let's launch into that.
The notification system, the most important notification system you can have in your house is a National Weather Service radio. One of those radios that picks up their direct broadcast to us to let us know what's going on. Have one of those, change the batteries regularly to make sure that you have a battery backup on it. You can tune them in. If you live in Ames, for instance, I always recommend that people have not just Story County in their weather radio, but have Boone County and possibly Dallas County, because most of our weather comes from the south and the southwest. This will give you another county's worth of warning to be able to transition to looking at those next items, which is our local media is very good to go on and see what they're having, especially if they have meteorologists that can interpret some of the information that's on the TV. Another thing is, most of your cell phones nowadays should have what we call the wireless emergency alert system. That will alert you to tornadoes and to flooding, flash flooding, but it won't alert you to the high winds or some of the other threats that might be out there. So possibly get some of those apps, those weather apps that are available to you, so that you can be well informed. Start your morning routine by getting a weather update, just like you had here, so that you can find out, is there a possibility of severe weather coming up? Am I going to be doing outdoor activities during that time? Is the family going to be divided up in different places when this weather is happening? How are we going to keep in touch with each other if it should strike?
Well, I don't want to just rush past this notification system. I don't know anything about a National Weather Service radio. I don't know where to get one. I don't know what it looks like. I don't know how to tune it into my county. What is that all about? Where do you go?
First off, just do weather radio search online, and all of the online services will have them available to buy. The system that you want to make sure is that it has SAME, which is makes it so that you can select which county has got which counties you want to get alerts for. The National Weather Service has a link on their webpage on how to program them. If you have difficulties programming them, give my office a call or stop by, and we'll assist you, because we feel that this is very, very important, and we can sit down and talk with you and see where you want to get your notifications from, and we'll help you program it, show you how to program it so that you can do it on your own later. In the springtime, you'll start to see them a lot more in the retailers around here. Hy-Vee is one of them that oftentimes is a good partner and really pushes out their weather radios so that people can purchase them. But if you have any problem, go online, search for Story County Emergency Management. Our contact information is there. My phone number is 382-7315. Give us a call, and we'll try and talk you through it. If need be, you can stop by, and we'll help you out with it.
Keith, we love you. You are so serious about this stuff. It's serious business. And I'm going to be looking for those. I don't know if we can really say the price, but maybe you could just kind of say a price range. What is this, kind of what are these things set you back?
Typically, they're going to run somewhere about $30, and then you can move all the way on up. You can keep adding features on them. Another item to have is a weather radio that I have one down in my basement that it's got a little solar battery power charger. It's got an LED flashlight on it. It has the weather radio on it. It has a hand crank. It could charge my cell phone if need be. That cost me about $30, $40 if I remember right. Plus, I have my portable weather radio that's right up by my bed. But it's one that I can take out of a charger and carry around with me, especially if I'm going to be doing stuff outside. So there's lots of different features on them. Typically, they're going to run somewhere between $30 to the more expensive ones, $60 to $80.
Okay. And is this something that you keep turned on all the time, or and then it will just produce those messages that need to be sent out, or is it something that you wouldn't want to have on all the time because it is constantly producing messages?
They're silent until there has been an alert put for the particular counties that you have selected. And I hear it all the time. Boy, it's loud when it goes off. That's exactly what we want it to be. We want it to wake you up and to make sure. I can hear mine when I'm downstairs, and you need that kind of volume to be able to alert you. But it's not making any noise unless you need to know something. So it's something that you should make sure that you have there so that you get that alert when you need it.
Okay. And looks like we are going to – this Severe Weather Awareness Week has some special activities associated with it. Am I correct?
Correct. We run through all of the different kinds. We'll talk about thunderstorms on one day. We'll put up on our Facebook page special information for thunderstorms, flash flooding. We're going to be having we'll talk about a little bit later the tornado drill that will be on Wednesday. And we give you little hints about each of these different mechanisms that I've pointed out where people are injured or killed due to severe weather and how you can prepare for it and how you can try and avoid the risk as much as possible.
When I think of tornado drill, I think of being in school, a kid. Are you doing any presentations to kids as part of Severe Weather Week?
We haven't been asked to go out to anywhere yet. What we did have, though, is 2 weeks ago, we had a storm spotter class. National Weather Service came up and presented a storm spotting class where anybody can get this training to be able to be a storm spotter, be more aware of what the National Weather Service is looking for when it comes to reporting back. Their radar is great, but still eyes on the ground are important, and we have a network. Our volunteer firefighters volunteer to go out in the middle of the night if need be to look at storms. But that's how we get some of the information back on that. Our office is always willing to go out and talk to businesses, schools, about their preparedness for severe weather. We won't tell them exactly where they need to go, but we'll talk with them on the risks that are associated with high winds and a structure so that they can make some choices as to where they might shelter during a storm.
Mm-hmm. And kids just love – I'm sure they'd love those stories about, you know, people – losing their lives due to severe weather.
Yeah, and we hope to engage children also anytime that we talk, because oftentimes that when they go home and talk to their parents about this sort of stuff, then we'll be able to really capture their attention. We want families to think about storms completely, because oftentimes, we are all in different places. The children might be at school, the parents might be at work. And we will also want them to think about in each of their different locations how they might protect themselves. And should there be a storm, how are they all going to get back together again and get the family back secure and reunified?
So the statewide tornado drill, what does that look like?
What it's going to be is we will be exercising our processes within the emergency management community, and the National Weather Service is going to generate the different watches and warnings as exercise drills for us to start running through our checklist. And it'll go up to our dispatch agencies, who will activate the outdoor warning sirens as a part of the drill, and we'll make sure that whole system works all the way through. The outdoor warning sirens haven't been used in a while. Every year, this is a good test to make sure that all of the different parts are connected to get those activated. And then we encourage, again, families and businesses to go ahead and run through their tornado drill as if it was the real thing and have a discussion with their staff and their employees on what they would do before, during, and after a tornado.
Okay, well, we are in Cyclone Alley, I guess.
Oh yes, we've already had the one that was in Seymour down in southeast Iowa that was, if I remember right, seen on TV, was about an EF3 tornado, which is pretty powerful this early in the season. Our most dangerous time for these tornadoes is coming up. It's in the springtime. And they can develop very, very rapidly.
Right. And the other really rapidly developing hazard are those floods.
The flash flooding is very dangerous, especially at night. And people can get into the water. But more often than not, people see the water that's there, and they say, oh, it can't be that deep. And they get themselves into trouble. It takes very, very little water, first off, to move a vehicle. And secondly, you don't know what's underneath that water. The road may not even be there anymore because the water has washed it away. It's not worth your life. Take a few minutes, drive on around so that you're not risking your life and the life of our first responders to go out into that fast-flowing water to try and retrieve you. Do us all a favor. Take those few minutes, drive around, turn around, don't drown.
Don't drown, turn around.
Yep.
That's what I remember from many. You've said that many times over into that microphone, I think.
I know, but we see it all the time. Anytime that there's flooding, you always see those people that are trapped on top of their cars. And the water didn't come up around them. They thought that they could get across. So maybe if we say it over and over again, people will finally start listening to it.
That's right. Well, anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to touch on before we move on?
One of the things that we saw last September was also that there was flash flooding here in Ames. And, make sure that your sump pumps are check them out. They may be stuck. Pour water down into your sumps and make sure that those sump pumps will activate when the water reaches the appropriate level. Also, look around any areas. Make sure that your eaves spouts are pushing the water as far away from your house as possible. And folks need to consider, are the areas around where they might have those emergency escapes, are they high enough to prevent water from coming into their house, which is what we had a lot of last September. You may need to do some landscaping. You've got to make sure, though, that emergency escape still functions as emergency escapes, but you may need to build it up a little bit and put some steps in there for people to be able to get out. But that's where a lot of the houses or some of the houses received damage last year. Get your plan together, walk through it, make sure you know what you're going to do.
Right. Those wet basements, that was a trial and tribulation for a lot of people I know.
It was. We had well over 100 houses that were affected last September. And after the storm, we didn't have any idea that many people had been affected by it. But it was pretty significant.
Okay. And landscaping, it's a great time to get out and dig. Go ahead and pile it up against the side of the house with the grade going away.
Yes, definitely. And look at, like I say, all those areas where water might, if you have recessed steps going down into a basement or something like that. Consider all of those different areas if the water gets to flowing much faster than what you're used to.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Keith, for coming in, as you always do, once a month, to give us a few pointers on how to be prepared.
Well, thank you, and hopefully everybody will disregard the snow out there and start thinking ahead to the warm spring.
Okay. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Is just as bad. Yeah, they call it Stormy Monday. But Tuesday's just as bad. You know, Wednesday's worse.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Well, in this time of stormy weather and seasonal change, the Octagon Center for the Arts in Ames has an exhibit in its community gallery that helps herald the coming of spring. Ursula Rudenberg reports.
The exhibit currently on display in the Community Gallery of the Octagon Center for the Arts is called Transcendence Through Observation. It contains photographs and mixed media paintings about birds and bird nests and how humans study them. The exhibit comes out of a collaboration between two first-year Master of Fine Arts students at the ISU Integrated Visual Arts Program, Rachel Deutmeyer and Anna Segner. An artist statement on the wall describes the show's central idea, how being in nature and observing it firsthand is a transcendent experience. The artists focus on the process of shifting our awareness from the human academic study of nature to directly experiencing nature firsthand. Anna and Rachel say that their exhibit studies the field of environmental discovery to discover truth beyond facts written in books, maps, and diagrams. I looked for a definition for the field of environmental discovery, and from what I could gather, it is a term used mostly by nature centers for introducing everyday people to nature in a more intimate way through personal experiences. The exhibit at the Octagon is indeed about making art by going out into nature and exploring it up close and firsthand. To learn more, I asked Rachel and Anna to come to KHOI last week to talk to me about their work. Rachel Deutmeyer described how environmental discovery was part of their artistic process. She works in various forms of photography and film.
We went through a few different parks and were looking for bird nests and looking at the bird boxes in these parks. And so it was a very engaging experience of exploration. And for me, it was a way to get out and have my own amateur experiments and explorations and looking for these things and learning about the land through my experience then with the land. And I did the photographs in the collection. Very few photographs were specifically sought out. It was more very flexible and fluid as I was out exploring. And so then the photographs are a way to continue to look at those things and learn more about them and study them more intimately.
So after you took the photographs, did you see more when you looked at the photographs?
Certainly, especially with some of the birds' nests. They are so incredibly intricate and detailed. And as they're printed larger and there's a specific photograph of a nest, nest, that the actual nest was much smaller than the photograph. So then seeing it larger, you really see all of the textures and the details in each little strand of what materials the birdman picked up to construct it. And so I think it's more informative than in being able to reflect and see through those photographs.
Did you find that you were able to get a little bit inside the bird's head by seeing how he constructed his nest?
Most specifically in one photograph, it was very fascinating to see. I opened a bird box and saw the structure of the nest that had been in there, and the bottom was a lot of sticks, and then the top was finer materials, and so it was very fascinating to see how the bird had built up this solid structure beneath then the softer materials. Very interesting to see sort of this scaffolding.
In their introduction to the exhibit, the artists refer to the conservationist Aldo Leopold, who advocated for people to simply interact with the land. They also quote the romantic poet William Wordsworth, who said, "Let nature be your teacher." Anna Segner, the other featured artist, explained how the idea of transcendence through observation led her to making this exhibit.
I studied literature in my undergrad, so for me a lot of it was you're reading these beautiful pieces of literature. I was focusing on the environment, and it felt like I was writing these beautiful papers about the environment, and you're trying to put together a worldview, or you're trying to put together a way to see the world, but then without actually engaging with the land, it felt like it was all for naught. It didn't really feel like it was a purpose unless I was applying that knowledge that I learned in academics to my own actual life, because I think learning is one thing and experiencing is another thing. Our show was kind of an effort to go beyond what you've read and what you've learned. And we talked a lot about nests, and we were thinking about that, and I started to think about that as, so like a bird's collecting all these physical pieces, sticks, mud, all these things to kind of collect. And I was thinking about that as my experience of collecting knowledge. And so that's kind of how I view mixed media.
Are you equating putting together a painting with building a nest?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Huh. So you were constantly seeing it as that.
Yeah. The nest was kind of the focal point, I think, and then it kind of evolved. But yeah.
So you're connecting to birds through artistry and craft.
Mm-hmm.
Why did both of you choose to focus on nests?
I think there's something about a home that's mm-hmm. so universal to all living things, where you put yourself to rest and how you create that space, I think is interesting.
Was there anything unusual about nests that you noticed once you started working on this project?
Well, nests are just always amazing to me. I think it's partially the discovery. No matter how much you know about something, when you actually find it in nature, it's like, whoa, that's real. And that's like it is in the text. Like, that's why they did that. But even if you know, it's just amazing to actually find it and see it and actually see how beautiful it is.
Collections, one of the paintings that I really liked. It's a mixed media. It has a nest with blue eggs on a branch with things the bird presumably collected that are mm-hmm. man-made, like scraps of paper that say used. And also there's things that you would write on. And there's text of landscapes.
Yep.
And postage stamps and a piece of newspaper showing birders.
Yeah.
And there's lots of other stuff.
Right.
Talk to me about that painting.
Being a mixed media artist, it really is like being a bird putting together a nest, because I'm always picking up these little weird scraps of paper and things. My idea behind that piece originally was you see nests and you're like, why did they pick up, like, why is that human object in there? Or even like magpies or something, they'll steal like a necklace or something and put it in. But it's like, that's so interesting that something that's our trash is in there in a way that may be like a negative, like they're resorting to using human found objects, but in a way they're just so brilliant and using whatever they can find and so resourceful. So I kind of thought of that as myself as a mixed media artist, and I was like, okay, I want to almost mimic that and also represent that too.
Are you saying that if your painting is like a nest, you're bringing in found objects mm-hmm. like the birds would?
Yeah, yeah. And also like a lot of the objects, yeah, are like garbage. But also I had a lot of pieces of bird guides, things that inform the birder or viewer of the nest and both the viewers of the painting.
So you were in a sense being a bird, building
yeah,
a nest?
Yeah.
In your mission statement, you talk about the field of environmental discovery. Can you explain what environmental discovery is?
You can read a ton about something and then when you see it, that's like two different planes of discovery in a way, and they're both relating to the environment. So when you're reading a book about nests at home, that's part of the environmental discovery. But then when you're actually outdoors and you find that nest, or when you, whatever it is, if you find that plant you've been reading about, it's all a discovery. And part of our mission statement, too, was about the importance of just curiosity and wondering about things and how that can lead to more asking those questions, those, oh, that's odd. Like, why did they do that? That's a big part of the environmental discovery. And being an amateur is a good thing. Being curious is a good thing. It leads to further knowledge.
So environmental discovery is an amateur activity?
Not in necessarily specific to any category of people or level of knowledge, but just as an open exploration without hesitation in, oh, I don't know enough yet, but just to start somewhere, and whether that's amateur or with some previous knowledge of what you're looking into, just to start and to engage with the land and learn that way.
What do you think the benefits of environmental discovery and curiosity are for people that aren't artists?
There are so many benefits of being outside and just getting fresh air and moving. And I think that the field of environmental discovery can really relate back to more of a childlike curiosity, having the freedom to walk and explore. And if something's interesting to you, get up close and look at it. Or if you find an interesting rock, having an appreciation of that and relating again to some of the smaller things that are often overlooked in the busyness of life that otherwise can consume our day to day. And so I think it presents a moment of pause and a moment of curiosity and so many benefits of learning about whatever may be interesting to someone. And trees and sky and cloud and prairie and all the different things that we take for granted and are sort of tucked away into the parks in Iowa. It's really important to engage with that and to know about where you live and the natural history of where you live.
Also, it just allows you to realize that you're a part of something larger as well. This is straight out of Aldo Leopold. Basically, he writes about how humans are just one part. They're a cog in the wheel. So being able to get out allows you to maybe not be so self-centered also, to see I'm a part of this entire thing. I'm just a piece of it, but I'm also a piece of it that's lucky to be a part of it. One thing that's been so interesting about this show, too, is everybody comes with their own interpretation or their own attachment to birds. Some people are super afraid of birds or like super creeped out by birds, or some people love birds. So then they want to talk about birds. And you're like, okay, that's, yeah, I love talking about birds. But it's just interesting how everybody has a different understanding of or experience with. And that's something that I kind of try to think about a lot in my paintings. So like there's some in flight and then there's also some that are dead, because that's two different views of what people have. Like, we have this such romantic view of like, oh, a bird in flight, that's us flying and expanding our view of the world. But also you'll be walking down the sidewalk and you'll see a dead bird and you'll be like, wow, like that's such a reminder of our mortality.
Do you have a favorite bird?
Oh, right now I really like the tufted titmouse.
Why the tufted titmouse?
It's just my newest discovery. It's the last bird I painted. I don't know.
It's kind of ambitious for first-year students to want to show. I mean, how did you even decide on a plan?
First of all, I feel like we're first-year students, right? So we need to do the show with another person in order to have enough work. But then through meeting with Coffee, it felt like, wow, this actually is a really good pairing. And I think between both of our interests,
were you both already thinking about birds?
I'm always thinking about birds.
I'm
like the crazy bird lady.
Why are you always thinking about birds?
I love them. My parents are birders.
And when did you decide to make that the subject of your show?
I had come to the table with a great interest in landscapes, or less specifically in birds, but then again became really interested in their resting places and the nests specifically. And so I think that became a bridging point.
I think originally we were thinking a lot about pairing human space and natural resting places, and then it evolved.
And did you go out on visual hunting exhibitions together, or was this independent of each other?
Both. Mm-hmm. We went to Ledges State Park a few times hiking, and would sometimes have a camera with me and Anna as well, and we would take photos for source images and ideas and just walk and talk and enjoy the land.
And did you discuss the show while you were walking and talking too, like discuss ideas for the show?
Yeah.
So the show reflects a lot of the ideas that you generated together while you were on these trips?
Mm-hmm.
You found that collaboration helped your process?
Certainly did for me.
It was really fun, too. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of times I, for sure, get very recluse. It just feels like a process I do on my own a lot. So for me, it was really fun to make it more social.
We are hearing from photographer Rachel Deutmeier and Anna Segner, who is a painter and mixed media artist. They collaborated on a show which is currently at the Octagon Center for the Arts in the Community Gallery, located at 427 Douglas Avenue in Ames. Their show will be up through April 1st, and the works are for sale. The exhibit focuses on the personal experience and observation of nature, juxtaposed with literature about nature and academic study of nature. Both artists are first-year graduate students at the ISU Integrated Visual Arts Program. One of Rachel's photographs made an impression on me as particularly memorable. I described it to her to find out more. A landscape with trees, and then superimposed over it, I think, is the surface of water with, I think, some ice in it. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that photograph?
Sure. The photograph is titled Celestial, and it's actually a straight photograph with no layering or alteration to the image. And so,
really? So that was a reflection in the water?
Right. Yeah.
Because it really looks like it's superimposed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a reflection on the perfect sunny afternoon where the vibrant colors are really coming through and the water was very still, allowing for a very clear reflection. And then the entire image is actually flipped upside down from how it was originally oriented. The grass was speckled at my feet, then that is turned so that it's at the top of the image and it allows for the grass to come through and look a little bit more like stars or galaxies above the trees. I like that the ice grounds the image and it can become very much like this celestial landscape, but then you notice the pieces of ice in the middle, and that sort of breaks up the understanding of the composition. So I'm really intrigued by the color and the observation and the stillness of the water and a lot of the artifacts of nature that are present in it, but also just the pure fact of how greatly observation can be altered and how a straight photograph then turned 180 degrees, become a totally different landscape, even though nothing's digitally changed about the file. And so I think there's just something that really alludes to, for lack of a better word, the magic of experience and just the curiosity that can come into play.
I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and we've been hearing from photographer Rachel Deutmeier and Anna Segner, a painter and mixed media artist. These two artists are first-year graduate students at the ISU Integrated Visual Arts Program and collaborated to create Transcendence Through Observation, an exhibit currently on display at the Octagon Center for the Arts Community Gallery. The gallery is located at 427 Douglas in Ames. Their show will be up through April 1st. Thank you for listening.
Just as bad. Yeah, they call it stormy Monday. But Tuesday's just as bad. You know, Wednesday's worse. Lord, and Thursday also said. The eagle flies on Friday, yeah. And Saturday I go out to play. I know you remember that, don't you? Hey, the eagle flies on Friday. when Saturday I go out to play. Sunday I go to church. Lord, and I kneel down to pray. I cry, Lord, help me.
I can't hear you.
Lord, have mercy on me.
Yeah.
I cry, Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy on me.
Work with it, Lord.
Hey, you know I'm trying to find my woman. Won't somebody please send her back to me? Wait, wait. On me. I cry, Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy on me. You know, I'm trying to find my woman. Won't somebody please send them back to me?
All right. Yeah, just like.
Well, you've been listening to Albert King and Stevie Ray Vaughan, the late great, playing Stormy Monday. This Monday is not quite as stormy as last Monday, but we do have some weather issues, and we hope you all stay safe here at KHOI Community Radio. And get out and shovel your walks, but be careful how you do it. Use your knees. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Today we heard a phenology on squirrel nests by Pat Schlarbaum, then spoke with coordinator of Story County Emergency Management Agency, Keith Morgan, about severe weather. After that, it was birds at the Octagon with a couple of ISU student artists sharing their work on the main floor gallery. Duck in there on Douglas Avenue and check it out. Our announcement for y'all, we will have musician and performer Evan Campbell here with us on Thursday evening, 7 to 8, as part of our Pantorium sessions. Evan will be playing with some friends, calling themselves Evan Campbell For Real, and they are for real. They are going to be here, and you can tune in at 7 p.m. on Thursday, listen to them live over the radio, or you can come into the studio and see them arrive a couple minutes early so that you don't disrupt the proceedings. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard, as I said, was Stormy Monday by Albert King and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Local Talk is a radio prediction training workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from C.Y. Stevens Auditorium, presenting Celtic Fire, an evening of songs, stories, tunes, and dance from the heart of the Emerald Isle. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.